Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Obviously, that's the famous line from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, describing a sailor surrounded by salt water, but it also describes modern-day Detroit. Even though the city is placed strategically on the Great Lakes as a transportation hub, thousands and thousands of residents are without water because the city's water and sewer department continues to cut off the water supply to residents who are behind on their water bills. The United Nations is saying it's a human rights abuse. Congressman Conyers is asking the president to step in with federal aid. And while the poorest of the poor are going without water, major businesses, including city-owned golf courses, have outstanding water bills to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the water is still flowing. Of course, we wanted to see where the situation falls on Nancy Kane's moral outrage meter and why so few in the media are even talking about this outrage. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. When we heard of this story, what are the first two words we said? Nancy Kane.
And I also said, I cannot believe this is going on. It's got so little attention. Please fill in the details here, Nancy Kane.
So this falls pretty far to the extremes on my moral outrage meter. I really couldn't believe it when I started reading the stories that Chelsea Mertz, one of your, you know, fantastic actors on the Boston Public Radio stage, sent me. So here are the brief outlines for our good listeners. So beginning in late winter, early spring, the Detroit Water Department, as part of, you know, the cost-cutting and cash-gathering aspects of a city in deep bankruptcy, decided that they would ferret out all the people, they say, that can pay but don't their water bills. I should add that the fresh water in the Great Lakes comprises 21% of the world's fresh water supply. So this is you got to understand the Shakespearean ironies here could not be bolder. I should also add that the average monthly water bill in Detroit is about $75, going up almost 10% this summer. That's twice as high as the national average. Just interestingly enough, again, a great irony considering they're literally lying on the edge of one of the Great Lakes. And I should also add that they have thus far, between late March and mid-June, cut off 12,500 families. Again, the intention is very clear. We believe, says the Water Department's deputy director, Mr. Latimer, we believe there are people who can pay and don't, so we're going to flush them out of the bushes, so to speak, no pun intended, by cutting off their water supply. So it's also perhaps worth mentioning that the unemployment rate in Detroit is 15%. Remember, that doesn't measure people who have given up looking for work in this city, which has been in free fall, economic free fall, for at least a decade, probably several decades longer. That 5 out of 10 children in that family live below the poverty line. And that the average per capita income is just a little north of $14,000. So this is the landscape in which we are going to try and get lean and mean and efficient by literally turning off the tap. So if, good listener, you choose to pursue this story, you can find not nearly as many hits on the internet as you'd like, but you can find some really, really heartrending and moral outrage creating video of people with no water, you know, getting jugs of water from friends.
Can't flush your toilet.
Can't flush your toilet.
Can't drink.
There's one woman, Nicole Miller, who's, you know, literally in this order, like gathering water that she drinks first, then uses to bathe her children, and she's doing this in gallon jugs and trash cans, folks. I mean, it is a scene from some of the kind of Peace Corps video that we see in shanty towns in the developing world, and the kind of conditions that this creates, not just in terms of human rights violations, because guess what? Most of the householders and renters that have unpaid water bills are most likely, we don't have documented evidence, in a city that's heavily African American, to be minorities. It's not just a human rights violation, says the United Nations. It's also a major health risk, because what happens when sanitation conditions in congested, blighted areas decline rapidly in the heat? Guess what happens? Cholera, typhoid, all kinds of stuff that we don't usually think of as having a kind of, you know, environment in which to breed in the first world, start breeding. So the United Nations, partly in response to Representative John Conyers' call, right, said, this is a health risk. Are you nuts? So that's, if you will, the place and the scene that we lay as we talk about this.
May I inject one thing?
Sure.
the city is going after any customer who's owes more than 100, who owes at least 150 bucks in 60 days.
Late. So
that's not big money.
No.
Meanwhile, you have places like Ford Field, where the Detroit Lions plays, that owes more than $55,000 at least as of April. They haven't paid. The Joe Louis Arena, home of the Detroit Red Wings, owes $82,000. So these
and the state of Michigan, I believe, owes over $1 million, right? Because the state fairgrounds haven't paid for the water they use there. So there's a lot of, you know, as I said, very, shall we say, lightly questionable inconsistencies in how we're applying this policy.
You know, the two things that struck me about this, other than the inhumanity here, I first read this story in the Los Angeles Times about 10 days ago. And because I had read it nowhere else, I question whether or not the story was real, mm-hmm. because it can't be that more than 10,000 people have had their water shut off in a major American city. And the two issues I'd like you to talk to in any order you want is, one, Chelsea, the same Chelsea you just mentioned, said if there were 13,000 people without water in Boston, it'd be the front page of the newspaper every single day until the crisis was dealt with.
And it would be the front page of the New York Times. It wouldn't just be the Boston Globe.
No, I said all across the country. Right, right. And as you said, I would argue that because the vast majority of people are poor and black in Detroit, that may explain it. But I'd like you to address the press thing. The second thing is, where is President Obama? This is a major American city. Someone said years ago, we searched this morning, couldn't find it. This is only when the bankruptcy happened in Detroit, not the water crisis, that Detroit's going to become Obama's Katrina. So in either order, why is the press ignoring this for the most part? And two, why is the president ignoring this?
Let me take the first question first. I thought about this weekend because I just couldn't believe this when I started digging into the, you know, say 10 newspaper articles you can find, including a very, very interesting op-ed piece loaded with facts from July 3rd by Anna Clark called Going Without Water in Detroit. Heartily commend it to our readers. The LA Times has another fantastic story by Scott Martell from June 27th, Cutting Off Water to Detroiters, Another Wrong Turn for Motor City. So I thought about this. The best answer I can give, and it's by no means a very, very strong one, is are we willing as journalists, as observers, as commentators to turn our back on Detroit and just let it die? Is that the easier thing to do because it's so troubled? We certainly have no trouble generating ink on General Motors, right? A major player in that city.
And which, by the way, which we bailed out. I mean, this
well,
president...
Well, that gets to the second question, right?
Yeah, okay.
He was willing to jump right in there, right? You know, hands forward off the high dive to help the auto manufacturers.
He's the president.
The president.
Yeah.
The president.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Congress generating that. Obama, right, cut the most important orders from his executive position on helping out Chrysler and General Motors. Remember, Ford took no help. But where is he, right? Where is Waldo in this, you know, most very important city in America, you know, a city that has represented some of America's greatest strengths, and a city that, through a series of forces larger than any single voter or household to control, including delinquent water bills, finds itself in a kind of free fall in which, right, the visible hand of government and of serious economic policy is needed to regenerate economic activity, community, and reverse what is now becoming, you know, shameful, right? Urban blight in which people are suffering at a level that most Americans, if they knew about this, would say, I can't believe this would happen in my country.
Yeah, but Nancy, what you just did is you're where I am, is you editorialized against the press and you editorialized against the president. But I don't hear an explanation.
Okay.
Let's start with the press. The press is never, when you said, have we decided to give up on Detroit? And I would guess the federal government has decided to give up on Detroit. But the media loves a horror story. So why is it that
because most of these people are black? Is it because most of these people are poor?
Yes.
So let me just remember.
It has something to do with it, unfortunately.
I think it does. So let me put my historian's hat on. I will never forget when Kennedy, the two Kennedy brothers, Jack and Bobby, were traveling in West Virginia as part of the 1960 primary campaign season. And Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy said to the reporters, basically said, I can't believe how poor people are. Now, they were from a rich, silver spoon kind of privileged existence. But by going to West Virginia and walking off the highways, right, television cameras turned on a group of people that have been poor and neglected in some sense, neglected in a metaphorical as well as a literal sense, for a long, long time. So ignoring the poor and ignoring, minorities are poor is unfortunately not new. We're just seeing a quite astounding incidence of it that is surprising in our 24/7 super connected, information rich moment. And I do think it's about poor and black and depressing. Mm-hmm. Instead of about, Upton Sinclair and the duty of the press is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Let's get back on that path and shine the light on this and get some relief and something that makes a little more sense than moving rapid fire, ready, shoot, aim on cutting off these people's water supply.
But you know what I think it has a lot to do with, too, in the reporting of this, and I have not seen it all, but some of the reporting I've seen, when you do stories about these crises like this, it's really important to find a good victim,
right,
because people will tear apart the victim. They'll say, oh, if it's a single mother with six kids,
right,
well, what is she doing having six kids? Or there was a mother in here that's off in college studying Homeland Security, and you could see the critics saying, well, why is she in college studying Homeland Security if she can't afford to pay her water bill? She should be out working at McDonald's,
yeah,
or something like that. Even with the there's this picking apart of victims. You see this all the time. I think it's relative to why we don't get so upset about inner city violence, because people say, oh, well, that kid was in a gang, or oh, well,
absolutely,
they had a gun in the house.
So,
know what I mean?
So just backing up, I mentioned a woman, Nicole Miller, I had the wrong name, Nicole Hill. So if you look at her, she is a black woman. She has several children. She's a single mom. She's worked. She has a job. She's heavy. Her kitchen is dirty.
Yep.
It's dirty partly because she doesn't have any have any water, and it's dirty because she works really hard, and the poor often live in dirtier conditions than wealthier people. She is a lot less attractive, right, than think about the school children shooting in Connecticut right now a year and 5 months ago, and how the press jumped on like that like it was – there was no tomorrow. Now, these people aren't dying. But some of them are likely to die as a result of a water shutoff. And there is a kind of moral outrage here that is very, very significant. Is it as significant as a crazy teenager shooting, kids at the school where he formerly attended? No. But is it a big deal? You bet. But I think a lot of it has to do with the attractiveness of those who suffer in a media, that in an age that is increasingly appearance, and socially very, very conscious.
Okay, so we've broken down why we think the press has irresponsibly not covered this adequately.
Can I say one other thing?
Yeah.
One other thing. So I think it's one thing. I think unlike, say, the shooting in the terrible shooting in Connecticut, like so many shootings in America, unlike other examples of catastrophes, Katrina, for example, what is the solution here? The solution is actually more complicated than send FEMA in there and do something.
Which may be why the president is not addressing it also, because there isn't a solution.
Well, there is a solution. There are several solutions. The world is ripe with solutions. It's just it's going to take a kind of consistency of leadership that we haven't seen from Barack Obama and from his team and from certainly not from Congress. So I think that there's something about this. So we get water reinstated, and then what? I think there's a little bit of a Jobian kind of wringing of the hands. Detroit is declining.
There's still 15%
unemployed. The elephants are dying. Can we do?
Yeah.
Again, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing.
The interesting, one of the many interesting and horrific parts about this, since I read the story in the LA Times, I think about 2 weeks ago, I've become obsessed with this. And I've trolled through television. You know who has done the best job, in my opinion, of capturing the essence of Detroit in 2014, even though this is pre-water crisis, mm-hmm, of all people, Anthony Bourdain. Now, most people know Anthony Bourdain as a food show.
He
goes all around the world, including American cities and states, and he sees everything through the prism of food, which I think is brilliant because it draws people in who may not be interested, as you say, because they're poor, mostly African-American. He does a brilliant job about the despair and little pockets of hope,
yeah,
in Detroit, including a chef from New York City who was famous who moved back because it was hometown, that sort of thing. So I really recommend checking out Anthony Bourdain's piece on Detroit that airs all the time, and you can get it online. So even if it turns out the press doesn't care And even if, or has chosen not to care, even if the President of the United States and Congress as a body have decided that Detroit is not worth our attention.
Unbelievable with Obama.
Why isn't there one, John Conyers, who I've actually, as I said, the John King had horrible experiences years ago, even though he's beloved by many of my liberal friends. Why is there not a pocket of why is the Congressional Black Caucus not screaming about this every single day?
Also, you've got very affluent suburbs around Detroit. It's not as if it's the whole place is a mess. The inner city is a mess. Yes. And there are pockets of Detroit, as Anthony Bourdain focused in on, that are doing quite well. And the burbs are doing fantastically. So that's the other thing that I find really bizarre. And the Canadians. You see that story this morning
about
the Canadians coming in? Because they're on the other side of the Great Lakes saying, we'll come in and help you. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
So, I'm not sure I have a really, trenchant answer to this. I keep thinking of something that Bono, the U2 singer, who's become quite the global activist, said many years ago about Africa. Before the first world got interested in Africa, he said, "How will we ever be able to look ourselves in the face if we just let Africa go down the tubes?" And this is exactly the same thing. So, my fellow listeners, my fellow Americans, how can we look ourselves in the face if we just say, "Let Detroit die"? That is just I just finished watching Middlemarch, the BBC production, right?
Was it good?
Of this amazing novel, which I've read many times. And at the very end, Dorothea, the heroine, who makes all kinds of mistakes. I mean, it's really a Bildung's roman about how we learn, about how we develop our character by learning from our mistakes, if we're willing to do that. She says, I think we owe something. I don't think the progress of mankind happens in huge leaps solely. It happens in all these small steps. I think we should do best if we could make, take the action that we can to relieve the suffering of our fellow creatures. And all of us know exactly what she's talking about, because we all know how it feels when we find ourselves in some kind of pocket of hope, whether it's that kid in Texas with his little bookstore giving and before the zoning department sets him, giving and getting books, whether it's the food kitchens all over the country feeding people, whether it's handing out clothes in some kind of church bazaar when you're giving clothes to the poor, whether it's just offering a ride to someone that you don't know very well because they have to carry their groceries home. We all know that we are truly alive when we're involved in extending some kind of helping hand. And P.S., we feel better, actually, when we're extending a helping hand to someone, let's remember the New Testament, right, who might not look exactly like us, the leper, right, the alcoholic, the woman who's stoned. It is all about our service to people. And I'm astounded. I'm breathless that our public servants and our writers on public service aren't more active in this moment in Detroit. Cry the beloved country.
And if it turns out you don't see the same injustice we do out there, again, let me hearken back to what I said Chelsea said to us this morning up in the newsroom. If 13,000 people were without water in Greater Boston, it would be
in
the
Roxbury.
Lead story on the news on every national and cable network, without exception.
Well,
it would be
what
huge.
Else is really weird here, and maybe I have missed it, but in often these catastrophes, there's funds. Send your $5, send your $10.
Yeah, Boston Strong.
Where's the fund to send money to these people and get through the immediate crisis and then figure out how to deal with it long term so people can turn their water back
on? That really is the issue. We only have 30 seconds. That really is the issue in Detroit, and you touched on this before, even if they solve the water crisis. This is a city that's lost a million of its inhabitants. It is really going down the tubes. It did a bankruptcy thing a couple of years ago. It's a real mess, and it is being totally ignored.
Well, no man is an island, right? Ask not for whom the bell tolls; it tolls for thee. So, what can we do? We need to jump up and
go back and read Middlemarch again, because you talk about it every week, and I think that's a book that I haven't read in 30 years.
We were discussing earlier in the show about how you start a book and you only get through 10 pages. Yeah. Nancy just said, I've read it many times.
25.
That's the difference between Nancy Kane and Jim Browdy. That would be me. I hate when people talk about themselves in the third person, and Marjorie Egan.
Nancy
you're great,
Kane
as
is with
always.
Us every Tuesday. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership, that is. Nancy, great to see you, as always. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. I'll be joined by Boston Globe editor Brian McGorry and our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Mertz, Will Rose, of Amanda McGowan, our engineer, John Parker, and our intern, Devin Karambulis. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening, and please listen again tomorrow.